Hello everyone, welcome to the Deep Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ross Edwards. Today we're tackling an amazingly fascinating problem in the philosophy of science, and I'm going to take you through some perhaps unusual, but I hope you will see that they are very well reasoned arguments as to how we can see this problem in a new way. This is the problem of how does our experience correlate with brain activity? So just before we get into that, I just want to say that I have new long-form episodes every Wednesday at 8 p.m. UK, 9 p.m. Central European Time, and 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And I have snippets of those long-form episodes every Thursday, Sunday, and Tuesday at the same time. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and a quick mention that you can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. There's a link in the description to that, and you can find my books there as well. I'd also like to say that this episode is part of my April series called The Philosophy of Science, and it is also part of my philosophy playlist, which you can find on the homepage of my website. Go to the website deep-psychology.com and scroll down. You'll see my episode categories, and if you hit philosophy, you'll see all of my philosophy episodes there. This is a new feature I've introduced to help you navigate all my episodes more easily, because I've got over 200 now. So it's really helpful to have these playlists, but you need to go to the website, because the podcast platforms don't let you create playlists. So this is a really fascinating topic today. And again, it's one that I see as like a huge philosophical hole in the scientific view of life. And basically, the general theme for today is that brain processes and our experience correlate, but correlation does not mean explanation or causation. In other words, things do not happen because of the brain. Now, if that seems very abstract, don't worry, because I'm going to have plenty of examples for you. And I want to say that this is a hugely relevant topic nowadays because of our awareness of mental health, you know, things like anxiety, depression, ADHD, and so on, are, you know, these things are talked about all the time now. And we, you know, things like psychotherapy and psychiatry and so on are very much accessible to most people now. And what is interesting is that this problem of the brain and how it does or doesn't create our experience influences how we treat these conditions. Because if we say, well, it's down to the brain ultimately, you know, I'm depressed because of the brain ultimately, then we're not going to treat our depression properly, for example. Now listen, I'm not a professional psychologist, and I'm looking at this topic from a more philosophical side, but of course this has huge implications for psychology, because psychology relies on neuroscience, a lot of it. And more generally, it just extends to our entire understanding of who we are and what life is, which is really what my interest is. And the problem is that scientists are pretty poor philosophers, and this topic is a clear example of how they are. Because we tend to pin the cause of things, you know, the cause of our psychology, the cause of our inner state, on the brain, on neural activity, on hardwiring, on statements like my brain does this or my brain thinks that. And so we typically overlook our inner state, and we overlook sort of our life circumstances in favor of things like neurochemistry. That is, we do not attribute the cause of things to our experience, but to the brain. Now, this is not a new problem. This is actually something that is I don't know when it was called this, but this is a problem in the philosophy of science called the hard problem of consciousness, and it's decades old. I don't know if it goes back to, say, the 1960s or even before that, but basically the hard problem of consciousness is basically, you know, how do we get subjective phenomena from our biology and from the brain and so on. And it's funny because to me it's not a problem. You know, to scientists it's a problem because the way they frame it is that the brain has to be the cause of it. But if you don't frame it in that way, it's not a problem because you realize that the whole problem relies on you defining that to be the cause, you see. If you don't, there is no problem. Now, this might sound very abstract, so let's take a very sort of basic example that might seem overly simple, but this is like a very representative example. It's like it shows you the entire problem of what we're talking about. So, for example, right, let's talk about the phenomenon of getting scared when you see a spider. Now, I don't know if you do. I typically don't, unless it's a big one. But, you know, it's quite a common thing that people have, arachnophobia. So, right, what do we have? If we see this as the brain causes us to get scared when we see a spider, what we're going to say is, well, we know that certain brain circuits light up when we get scared, for example, the amygdala, and we know that when they light up, we feel fear. So this means that that brain activity causes us to feel fear. That's the causation statement. So it's basically your brain lights up, and this is oversimplifying it, but let's say the brain lights up, you feel fear. So that's our usual explanation for things, isn't it? And it's not just about spiders, it's really about the brain in general. This is how we explain things. We explain things, well, the brain lights up, and so that causes our inner state. However, the correlation statement would say, we feel fear. We know that when humans feel fear, that certain brain circuits activate. Often, you know, it's different for each person, but there are patterns. And we see that the two occur at the same time. That's a correlation statement. Now, what I'm basically saying in this entire episode is that the causation statement, that is, your brain circuits light up, therefore you feel fear, is not a true statement. What we can say is that there is a correlation. We can say our brain circuits are light up and we feel fear, but not therefore we feel fear. It's just an and. It's just and simultaneously we feel fear. Okay? So listen, let's break this down a bit. So when you see a spider, what happens? Let's say you're scared of them. You see a spider, what happens? You feel the fear. That is what you feel. That is your experience. Your experience is the fear. Your experience is not about your brain activity. Like I'm talking about your direct experience is the fear. You know, you get this emotion coming up, you get tense, you get anxious, you call on someone to help you out. This is fear expressing itself, right? That is your experience. You do not experience the brain. At what point do you see the brain? At what point do you experience your neural circuitry? You don't experience that at any point. I think that's quite obvious. So your experience is fear, right? And we all know what fear feels like. So there's no surprise there, and it might seem quite obvious, but listen. So from your own experience, you do not experience the brain and you do not experience your brain circuitry lighting up. Now, okay, listen, if I then hook you up to some electrodes and I measure certain areas of the brain and I expose you to a spider, for example, we're going to see that on, I don't know what the device is called, but on the device, we're going to see that there's activity in those areas. Okay, so what do we have? We have you getting scared, and we have the observation measurement of brain activity in certain areas when you get scared. And then when the spider goes away, there might be some residual fear, but it will dissipate, right? The fear will dissipate, and the measurement of the brain activity will dissipate. So our usual thinking, just to reiterate, because this is like the heart of this entire episode right here, to reiterate, we usually say, right, I felt fear because the amygdala activated in my brain. And if it didn't activate, I wouldn't feel that fear. So it's because of my brain. Right, now I want you to, this is our usual explanation for an example like this. Oh, my brain felt fear, my brain all lighted up and got me scared, right? We might not say this out loud, but this is typically how we view it. Do you see the problem with this? Like, do you see the there's a bridge that's being, there's a gap that's being bridged that I don't think we should be bridging? You know, do you see the way that we're jumping to a conclusion here that the brain is responsible just because it activates? I really hope you can see that, right? I really do. I really hope that you see the problem here. I mean, for one thing, you do not experience your brain. In fact, when you're seeing the spider, you don't give a shit about your brain. What you're caring about is the spider and the fact that you're scared, right? You have no interest in your brain at that moment, right? And the experience of fear is a visceral thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a psychological thing. It's a mental thing. And it hasn't, you know, compare the actual experience of fear to the measurement of brain activity on a screen. Maybe it's a graph over time of like brain waves, or maybe it's numbers on a screen, or, you know, some sort of visual representation of brain activity, right? Notice how different that representation is from the fear. It's completely different. And then the other problem is, just because your brain is active, how does that mean that it causes the fear? How is that explained? Now you see, the way the neuroscientist would explain this is saying something like, well, the brain activates, and therefore that is what produces the fear. You know, the neural circuitry activates and your nervous system activates, and then that creates the experience of fear. So it creates this knock-on effect. But what that is not the point I'm trying to make. You know, if you measure that stuff, you're going to see it. You know, you're going to see all this biological reaction happening. But what I'm saying is, that is not the same as a cause. That is still not a cause. Where is the causal aspect of that? Like, I'm genuinely curious to know. I mean, frankly, I don't see the cause. I don't see how that's causality. I can see the correlation. I don't see the causality. The problem is that because this is like dogma in our culture and in science, is to say that the brain is causing the fear of our, you know, it's causing the fear reaction. But no, it's not. How is it causing it? How is it causing it? If anything, well, listen, we'll come back to what the cause could be in a minute. But what I want to say is that we take what is a correlation and we jump to a conclusion and say it's a cause. You know, the brain is causing the fear. So what we're doing is we're mistaking practical correlative information. You know, this is vital information, vital neuroscientific information. But we're mistaking that for serious explanation about how human beings work. Because if we say the brain is the cause, then that changes our entire understanding of human behavior, of human psychology, and of human happiness and so on. You see? Let's take, and this doesn't just apply to fear. This applies to anything that we describe the brain in terms of the brain. So pretty much all of human behavior. Like, for example, we use it for, like, in sort of popular culture, we use it for thoughts as well and in everyday language. So we say things like, my brain starts thinking this, or my brain goes round in loops. These are cliches, like these are part of our everyday language and we don't really think about them. But have you ever thought about this? Have you ever thought about saying what the problem is with saying my brain thinks this or that? Your brain doesn't think anything. Right. Your brain, let me just repeat that. Your brain does not think anything. Right? Let me explain this. You have the experience of thought. You're a human being. We all have experience of thoughts. We all know what thoughts are like. You know, now, if you do meditation, you get a much better understanding of what thoughts are. But in any case, we all experience thoughts all the time. We're humans. We have that. And then we have, well, if we measure brain activity, you know, we measure the prefrontal cortex, we're going to see that when we're thinking that our prefrontal cortex lights up. So what we do is we say, oh, the brain is thinking. The brain is not thinking. You are experiencing thought. You're not experiencing your brain because your brain is not mental sounds or mental images. That is not your brain. Your mental sounds and mental images are mental sounds and mental images, right? That is, you're not experiencing your brain, right? Now, what I'll also say is that your brain can't think anything because your brain is just flesh and tissue and, you know, if we choose to measure it, things like neural activity and then cells on a microscopic level. That, where are the thoughts? There are no thoughts. You cannot look into your brain and see or hear thoughts. Your brain does not think anything. So what's happening is we have your experience. Your human experience is thoughts and images in your mind. That is the human mind, is thoughts and images. That is the human experience. We have correlative neuroscientific information, neurological information that says when this happens, certain areas of the brain light up. So that's what we have. We do not have the brain is thinking. That is not what... That is not what, like, that is not how it works. And we certainly do not have, you know, the brain causes thinking. No, you're experiencing the human experience. And we have correlative information about what the brain is doing. That is not enough to say that the brain does it or the brain is thinking this or that. Not only because the brain is the brain and it's not thoughts, but because correlation is not causation, you see. I really hope you understand this because it's really difficult to describe. It seems very obvious to me, but it's very difficult to like convincingly describe it. I'm trying my best, but I really just hope the penny drops that I'm not dismissing the brain activity. What I'm just saying is, we're taking incomplete information and we're jumping to conclusions. You know, we're saying that one causes the other. So let me explain this in a very general sense without reference to any particular example. So what actually is the brain? You know, if I was to give you my brain, what would it be? Well, as I've said, it's a squidgy lump of tissue. on an electrochemical level, we could say it's brain chemistry and it's neural activity, it's like electrical charges and so on, right? So it's sort of like this organ that if we measure things, we can see there's electrochemical activity there, right? That's it. That's the brain. That is it. That is what the brain is. The brain is nothing else but that. Literally, that is all it is. Really take that in. Now, what we have also is human experience. Now, this is subjective, it's qualitative, it's lived, it's phenomenological, which means it's made up of phenomena. And it's not physical, because your phenomenology, your experience is not physical. Like, your thoughts are not physical things. You think of your family right now. Is that physical? Has that got anything to do with your brain? Has that got anything to do with brain tissue? No. It's thoughts about your family. You know, maybe you're seeing your family, maybe you're remembering things, maybe you're hearing the voice of your family members, right? That is not brain tissue. So experience is like, and usually we can't describe our experience very well. Like, if, classic example, if I ask you to tell me what a strawberry tastes like, you can describe it to some degree. You can't really tell me what it is in such a way that I would be able to recreate that through concepts, through the concepts you give me. Or if you describe to me what a sunset is like, and I've never seen a sunset, well, you can say a lot of words, but you're never going to capture it, because it's phenomenological. It cannot be captured in concepts, right? So our experience is its own domain, right? Our experience is a totally different domain from brain chemistry and from neural activity. You cannot fit our experience into that. You cannot do that. Now, what we have, as I've said, and I want to just reiterate this, that we have our experience, one class of phenomena. We have brain states, that's another class of phenomena. And there's an observed relationship between the two. But this doesn't say that one causes the other. It doesn't say that the brain causes experience, and it doesn't say that experience causes brain activity. All we know is that they are correlated somehow. What's the problem here? And why does this happen? The reason I think this happens is because basically science is obsessed, but obsessed to the point that this underlies the entire sort of scientific endeavor, for better or for worse. Science is obsessed with pinning causes to a physical substrate. It needs to say that, you know, our experience is caused by the brain, because the brain is something we can measure. It's something physical, at least we think it is, which is debatable in and of itself. But I've spoken about that last month a little bit. It pins everything down to physical causes, even things like the beginnings of the universe. You know, it pins it down to random, like, subatomic, like a big bang that came from an infinitesimally small point in space and time. So it's trying to pin it down to a physical thing. So now, again, this is its own, that could be its own episode right there, whole discussion about that. But I'm just saying, notice it's a bias that science has. Now, I'm not saying it's never true, right? And I'm not saying it's not a useful thing in some circumstances, because it is. However, when it comes to things like psychology and our understanding of reality and the human being, it's very limiting. And it's an assumption that we're making. And as I said last week, my Wednesday episode last week, an assumption is something that we are presupposing to be true without actual evidence that it's true. And this is what we're doing with assuming that the brain causes things. Now, I'm going to address a really common argument against what I'm saying here. Now, let me give you an example. You might say, well, Ross, listen, if I knock my head really badly and I get brain damaged, then my memory will get altered really badly. Now, what this tells us is that the brain damage was the cause of my memory being altered, because before my head knock, my memory was perfect, and now I've had my head knock, I've got brain damage, and this means that the brain damage caused my memory loss, and therefore the brain is responsible for memory. And you might say, well, if I hadn't damaged my brain, my memory would be fine. Okay, right, I get your argument. That is, it's a strong argument. It's an interesting argument. But it still doesn't prove your brain is responsible. It doesn't prove that. And let me give you a reason why. Our brain is creating new memories all the time. So, well, I'm even careful to say something like that, because our brain doesn't have memories. Our brain has neurological activity, right, that encode our memories. So those are different things. But I'll use simplistic everyday language here. Our brains create new memories all the time. You know, every single second, remember, you know, this podcast you're listening to right now, tomorrow you'll maybe remember this, I hope you do, and then you could trace that memory to a new neural network that is formed in your brain, right? So that nothing happened on a neurological level. Like, I didn't change your brain directly. However, the experience of listening to this podcast changes your brain. So I could say, well, this experience causes the brain memory to be formed. It causes neural circuitry to be formed. Therefore, experience causes brain activity, right? So your example of the brain damage, it seems like a good example, because what is most obvious is the fact that the brain is actually damaged. Like, if you do an x-ray on someone that's had a bad head knock, you'll see that their brain is damaged and that their memory is altered. Therefore, it's kind of tempting to say, well, it's the brain that caused that. But think about it more carefully, right? You get a knock to the head. Now, what is your actual experience? You get a knock to the head, you're going to feel weird for a while, and then once you come round, or once you come back, you know, once you come back from being unconscious, you're going to notice that you don't have your memories anymore. Now, that would happen regardless of whether you knew you had a brain or not, right? It doesn't matter. Like, if that happened 10,000 years ago, they wouldn't, the effects, I'm assuming, would have been the same. Like, if some Stone Age man fell and hit his head on a rock and fell unconscious and then woke up and he'd lost some memories or whatever, he wouldn't know it was anything. He wouldn't have any reference to the brain. I mean, I'm sure he knew that a brain exists, because he probably saw bodies and and animals' bodies and carcasses and stuff like that. They probably knew that a brain existed, but they wouldn't have made the connection, I'm assuming, right? So there may not be a clear experiential explanation. You know, you might say, well, experientially, how, without referencing the brain, how do we understand that if I get a knock to the head that I must lose memories from that? I don't know if there's an experiential explanation for that, right? But the experience stands on its own, regardless of whether we understand why it does that. What I mean by the experience standing on its own is that without even referencing brain activity, without even understanding brain activity, the experience still happens. You know, you still experience the memory loss. It doesn't really matter if you know about neural activity or not, or if we understand it via that way or not. It's just that when we know that there's a correlation between memory and the brain, and then when we get physical, visible brain damage, that there's memory loss, our temptation is to say that's because of the brain. It's because brain encodes memories and because the brain does this and that. But again, it's a correlation, it's not a causation. And quite clearly, it's easy. I mean, listen, the brain literally is changing all the time due to our experience. This is literally what modern neuroscience tells us. Like, neuroplasticity tells us this, that the brain is constantly changing in response to experience. So you have to ask, well, what is causing... it's like the whole argument breaks down at that point, you see? So what my argument is that brain stimulation, you know, we can stimulate a brain in any way we want. And, you know, I could change your neurochemistry. I give you like a tablet or something or a drug and I can change your neurochemistry, right? So it seems that brain stimulation would change experience. However, again, what I'm saying is that the experience of, say, taking a drug and having your experience changed, that stands on its own, right? It doesn't, you don't need to refer to brain experience to explain that. I don't, you know, as I said, how do we explain it without referencing brain chemistry? I don't know. But clearly there's a pretty consistent effect that happens when you drink alcohol, for example. How do we explain it experientially? I don't know. I don't know. But it doesn't mean that the brain is the cause of anything, right? We can also say, on the other hand, that external changes or our experience changes our brain activity. So both directions show causation. So we can't, even on that level, beyond the actual critique of saying that the brain causes something, we can say that, listen, if there is a cause, like if one causes the other, then clearly they both cause each other. And more obviously in some circumstances than others. You might be wondering at this point, you know, okay, Ross, I'm on board with what you're saying here, but why does this matter? Like, so fucking what? Like, how does this change my life? Well, for one thing, I think it's really important to understand your experience on an experiential level, because what we've done, I mean, listen, I'm going to say that this is a modern thing, but I'm sort of making a huge assumption here. You know, at school, when we're taught about maths and science and blah, 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 this is all conceptual knowledge, right? And it's not phenomenological in any way. You know, we're not being taught to understand our experience from the inside. We're being taught, you know, what are our models for our human experience? And we're taught that that is the cause of them. And it's all conceptual. And what this does is it removes us from our direct experience, you see. And this is a great shame, because what you'll find is that by understanding your direct experience, you know, the thoughts you're having, the emotions you're having, how your body feels, how, you know, how it feels to be you, how it feels to be alive moment to moment to moment throughout the day, this is like the intel you need to understand yourself and to understand reality. You actually don't need to understand brain chemistry so much if you want to understand, you know, why you do the things that you do, or why you have certain habits, or I don't know, anything about yourself. You don't need to understand brain chemistry. What is more primary is our experience. And again, we've lost touch with our I don't want to say we've lost touch, because that assumes we were hugely in touch with it beforehand, which isn't necessarily true. Being lost in concept deprives us of our direct experience, right? And what you'll discover through, say, spiritual work or psychological work or any kind of inner work is that understanding your experience directly is absolutely crucial for understanding yourself and how you live life. It also helps you overcome the materialist paradigm, because What the materialist paradigm basically says is that fundamentally reality is physical, both at a subatomic and at just like a human level, like the human scale, that reality is physical, and that everything has a physical cause at the end of the day. Now, clearly, I've proven that that is not the case. Like, in neuroscience, that is not the case, right? So this is just a huge intellectual shift to overcome the materialist paradigm, because, quite frankly, we're stuck in it in the West and in modern countries. We're really stuck in the materialist paradigm. And yes, it's been very useful, but it's not the final, you know, if you look at human development, go and check out my episodes on spiral dynamics or on developmental psychology. Head to the homepage on my website and the categories there for those categories and listen to those for the stages of human development. And you'll realize that the materialist paradigm arises from a rational perspective, from a modern perspective, from a spiral dynamic stage orange perspective. And this is a stage in human development where the materialist paradigm makes sense, and it's sort of the natural explanation for how things work. However, there are higher stages beyond the rational, the modern stage. And so the more you cling to the materialist paradigm, the more as a society we cling to the materialist paradigm, the more we are locking ourselves into a stage of development which, in other, you know, we may well be ready to move beyond, okay? And quite frankly, you're just limiting yourself in terms of your understanding of life, in terms of your understanding of yourself. It refines your thinking. You know, thinking about these things carefully, whether or not we can draw the conclusion that the brain causes experience just because we see that the brain is active as we have certain experiences, it refines your thinking, because this is really just scientific dogma. It's laziness. It's jumping to conclusions. And this is not very scientific, is it? Science is supposed to be about careful measurement, careful deduction, careful this, careful that. You know, drawing conclusions carefully and thoughtfully. But saying things like the brain causes this, or this is because of this neural, like this circuit or that circuit, or this chemical, this neurochemical, this is very lazy thinking, as I hope you've seen. And most importantly, this should help you open your mind to what science cannot grasp or measure through its own paradigm. And this is not just about contacting your experience and understanding yourself through your direct experience. It's basically the fact that the deepest understanding of reality is experiential. And you might ask, well, what's the deepest understanding of reality? I would really advise you to go back to last month's episode, my series from March on spirituality, where I talk about what the deepest realizations in spirituality are. And what you're going to realize is that they are experiential realizations. They're not, and you won't see them in a science textbook or whatever. You won't hear about them from your science lecturer or teacher, because it's just in a different domain altogether. Like, science just does not deal with this stuff. And what a tragic shame, really, to be deprived of the deepest understanding of reality by clinging to science, right? This is really what it's about for me. It's simply that the deepest understanding of ourselves and of reality is experiential. It cannot be explained or obtained through concepts, by thinking about things, by offloading the cause of things to something external, right? To something physical. It has to be an experiential realization. Now, here's the big kicker in all of this. And this is where I really think that your understanding of this topic can become really go to a new level. Listen, usually what we say is that the brain is responsible for our experience. You know, that is our experience, you know, our sight, sounds, our touches, our mental images, our sounds, our whole human experience is basically caused by the brain. But we're talking about the brain here. What actually is the brain? You know, what do we know of the brain? Well, as I've said, all we have of our brain is what we see of it. You know, we either see a brain lying before us, like the squidgy lump of tissue before us, or we see brain activity on a screen, or we see images of a brain, like in a book or on the internet or something. We have our sight, you know, we have our visual experience of the brain, right? And that visual experience of the brain, again, is just, that is what it is. It is the visual experience, it's the appearance of the brain, and it is secondhand measurement of brain activity. That's all we have of the brain. Most of us actually have never seen a brain in person. I've never seen a brain. I don't know if you've ever seen one, perhaps in like a lab or something, or if you work and if you're a surgeon or something, you've seen a brain, right? But listen, most of us have probably never seen a brain, and no one will ever see their own brain. I mean, that might have happened at some point in human history, I don't know, but I doubt anyone has seen their own brain. I'm not sure about that. I really doubt that. That is all we have, and we have our visual experience of the brain as like the appearance of it or secondhand measurement of it. And most of us have never seen our own brain and never will. Right? So what I'm basically saying is that literally the brain is part of our experience. The brain is part of our experience. All we know of the brain is what is our experience of the brain. That is all we know of it. Now, this is like the entire paradigm turned upside down, because our usual paradigm is, well, the brain is responsible for experience. But what I'm saying is that the brain arises in experience. All we know of the brain, and I remind you, all we know of the brain is like images we've seen of on the internet or in a book or something, or seeing it in front of us, like if we're a surgeon or if we dissect a human head or something, or an animal, or we have indirect measurement of brain activity. That is literally all we have of it. We have nothing else. Never in human history have we had anything else other than that of the brain. So all we know of the brain is our experience of it. And we want to say that our experience is caused by the brain. You see the very circular problem here. It's kind of like the eyeball trying to see itself. The eye cannot see itself, right? Other than in a mirror, you've never seen your own eye, right? So we use our experience to try and understand the source of our experience, and we pin it to something that only arises within our experience. You see the problem? Now, I don't know what the solution to this is. My solution is simply that our experience is primary, and that there is no, we cannot pin it to the brain. All we can say is that, yes, the brain, our brain experience may well correlate with it, but we cannot pin it down to the brain. Our experience just is, right? Our experience is primary. And for example, when we get scared, we get scared because we see a spider. We get scared because of the spider and all our associations that we have. We don't get scared because of our brain. Granted, without our brain, we wouldn't get scared. But that's a bit of a silly argument to make, because, I mean, obviously, that's like kind of saying, without our legs, we couldn't walk. Well, so what? That doesn't explain the act of walking. The fact of having legs doesn't explain the act of walking, right? So that's the big kicker. It's that our brain, all we have of our brain is our experience of it. and yet we're trying to ground our experience in the brain. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So, what is our conclusion here? Well, our conclusion is that we cannot conclude that the brain causes our experience or any specific experience or any condition, including like depression, anxiety, or stress or anything. All we can say is that it gives us useful correlational information and it gives us useful practical information, but it doesn't, you know, practicality is not the same as understanding. That is really important to understand. And scientists have known this for a very long time. When quantum mechanics was discovered or invented, they stopped, you know, a certain group of the scientific community said, we don't understand quantum mechanics, but it doesn't matter because we can use it very well. So clearly, there's a difference between practicality and understanding. And I would say the same thing is happening here. You know, practically, we know that by altering the brain, we can alter our experience and vice versa. And we make the lazy conclusion that our brain causes our experience because we really love physical explanations for things, especially scientists, and also because these things have just become cliches, to be quite honest with you. And ultimately, my conclusion is that basically our experience is primary and our experience speaks for itself. It stands on its own. Alright everyone, just to remind you, I have new long form episodes every Wednesday and snippets on Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday. This all comes out, every episode comes out 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. You can find a link in the description for that. And you can find links to my books there as well. Also, make sure to check out my other episodes this month from my Philosophy of Science series. And make sure to head to deep-psychology.com for my philosophy playlist. Just scroll down or you can follow the link in the description to that. And of course, make sure to tune in every Wednesday. And of course, thank you for listening. It's been a joy and a pleasure once again, and I will see you in the next episode for more on the philosophy of science. Take care.